Going fishing. Australia's nuclear technology podcast. This is a guest who's been on my radar pretty much as soon as I started going fishing, and it's a tragedy that I've taken this long to interview the man. You guys have waited long enough, so please enjoy the interview. G'day, Oscar Archer. This has been a long time coming. How are you doing?
Good morning.
Look, anyone who's sort of been on Twitter or X as it is now, or anyone that's been following this podcast, I'm sure would have already encountered yourself and your presence online. But for those, you know, that might not know, would you like to give a brief introduction of who you are?
Oh, yeah, that's no problem. I'm Oscar Archer. I have a doctorate in organic chemistry from Adelaide University.
Why did this attract you? Like, what brought you into that?
Ah, well, I went into chemistry because it was really interesting to see things going together at a fundamental level, and there were a few projects on offer that were related to molecular mechanics, or more broadly, nanotechnology. So just got to do a lot of bench work and analysis on that sort of chemistry, different chemical techniques. And the main benefit of that was just learning a lot of scientific thinking and scientific research skills, which ends up being a really good fundamental basis for researching nearly anything, actually.
Okay, so you mentioned, what did you say, it was molecular mechanics. Was this sort of a specific area of focus, and is this what attracted you towards doing the doctorate?
It was, and I was fortunate to have a bit of a variety of projects, ranging from building molecular cogs, up to modifying water-soluble polymers with the intention of having them sort of zip together like a zipper, or couple to... hard to explain.
This sounds like, and this is not my area, but this sounds like an application of... I think you said this... this is an application of nanotechnology or nanomechanics, or...
I mean, it is an approach to nanotechnology. From the chemical side rather than the physics side.
Okay, so what does that mean? Because my understanding was that the idea of nanotechnology is you make little machines like the cogs that you mentioned at the is it the quantum scale?
Not quite quantum. We're talking the chemical scale, but it's the great thing about it is we already know that it works because natural biological machinery does this, and it does it at a certain scale. We can't, in chemistry, in organic chemistry, you're working at a slightly smaller scale than that. Enzymes and those molecules tend to be really large. I was synthesizing molecules at maybe an order of magnitude lower molecular weight. And just trying to get them to behave in a uniform way. But it was really fundamental stuff, as in way below any practical application at that point.
Yeah, okay.
But it was quite a lot of fun. A lot of playtime in the lab, but also some interesting results came out.
A lot of throwing mud at the wall and seeing what sticks.
It was a bit like that, but also because you're trying to synthesize molecules that are analogous to the sort of machinery we're all familiar with, there is a definite sort of goal that you're aiming for. Yeah.
So moving on from that, currently you work in arguably the industrial cornerstone of Australian culture, and that is a malthouse. Can you tell us what goes on in such a place?
After I finished my PhD and got out of the part-time work I was doing to support myself, I had the opportunity to start work at a Yeah, a facility we have here in South Australia. It was so started off and started learning how to operate the plant. And
What does it actually produce? Like, what is the malt that you produce? Because I understand it's part of the brewing process, but
right.
sort of what is that?
It is. So what I do is make malt out of barley. We can also make malt out of wheat, and it's an entire process by itself. Obviously it's for brewing and for distilling and other products. It's a pretty versatile processed food stuff. We make it at an industrial scale, so there's a aspect of economies of scale involved, and it's a full-blown factory, so it needs to be maintained by fitters and electricians, and it needs to be operated by people who understand the process, understand the craft. And yeah, I was able to start this job. I left it for a little while, and did other things in life, including raising a couple of kids, a bit of relocation. Came back here a few years back and had the opportunity to take up my role, and things had changed a lot. The place was being operated a lot more efficiently, with a lot more attention to detail and a lot more emphasis on analysis of operational data, which is something I'm elbow deep in every day. The efficiency is the name of the game in operating this place. It's all to do with minimizing inputs and maximizing tonnage output. That's just inherent to an industrial process.
Okay, so well, talking about minimizing your inputs to maximizing your outputs, I'm guessing a large part of the inputs are going to be your energy. Is that accurate?
It is. It uses electricity. It uses gas, in kilns, and we use water. And we need to make sure that waste materials are not going to do any harm, comply with EPA expectations. And we report our usage, to head office. We've got budgets to meet and beat. And it's all a lot of very clear focus on what to do. But it sounds a bit numerical and dry, the way I describe it. But fortunately, the smell is heavenly. And the product is delicious. I've had plenty of time, actually, since being involved as an energy advocate, to otherwise reflect on all of this. And it became obvious to me many years ago that I wouldn't want to work anywhere else. Very fortunate to love my job.
Excellent. When you say actually, just going back, when you're talking about creating the malt, is that a fermentation process to create the malt, or is that later on when it comes to brewing?
It's a good question. It is later on.
Okay.
We tend to want to avoid fermentation. Malt is simply the germination process. And the craft comes where we are germinating it very carefully to maximize what the brewers will want from the finished product.
Having cheap energy, and whether it be that electricity or gas, because this sounds like it's a confluence of two important parts of the sort of the energy the energy pie. One is electricity and one is the industrial heat application. It's fairly obvious why a facility like this would like to or would benefit from having those inputs being cheap and reliable.
And clean.
And clean.
Yes, I started this job and it was a gradual process while spending my spare time finding the online blogs of people like Barry Brook, Ben Hurd, and Rod Adams, reading through all of the old comment sections, basically just reading the backlog of material, and really thinking further on the issue of energy usage that I started back when I was at university, when I learned about the concept of peak oil. Peak oil is inherently a dystopian idea, but they do. Peak oil scholars tend to think about concepts like energy return on energy invested, and then in the same breath, we'll dismiss nuclear power, for example. And you know, if you learn about this and then keep reading, for me anyway, something didn't feel right. After finding out about thorium in a really random way, I just kept reading. And while I was getting used to working in an actual factory where this stuff is what we live and breathe, you know, energy inputs, sort of dawned on me, hey, what could we use instead of gas for heating? And just spurred me on to keep reading up, and then I was reading through Ben Hurd's Decarbonize essay blog. Dane Eckerman had guest written an article about the details around why and how nuclear energy was prohibited back at the end of the 90s, and I got quite annoyed by those details. I think most people who read about it probably are, and I had to sit down and think, okay, what am I going to do here, because I can now see how much effort it's going to be to get involved in this if I want to be talking about this and properly helping. I kind of need to establish myself, which I had no experience in doing, but I had to kind of start at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And I just decided I want to do it my way. What do we want to do? We want to use all of the useful actinide elements to make energy, because it does it cleanly. We can consume them all. Okay, we want to enter the age of actinides. So I call my blog the Actinide Age, and I just started writing down everything I was reading about, and practicing composing what I write, which I enjoyed immensely. I wouldn't have kept doing it if I didn't enjoy it, but I had the time back then, and I basically just wrote as I learned, and identified, you know, all the different concepts that I'd have to get familiar with, whether it's the difference between kilowatt hours and megajoules, you know, electricity versus energy, what radiation measurements mean, the merit order in electricity grids, source terms for nuclear reactor cores, just all these disparate concepts that if you're going to be talking and inevitably arguing with people, it's good to be on top of most or all of these things. And, you know, I'd up to that point, I had the sort of brain that could just memorize, you know, Star Trek facts.
Well, interesting to mention that, because no one runs a Starship Enterprise or anything like that off solar and wind.
Well,
it's always
that's
got
right.
some
it's,
kind of nuclear power.
They are nuclear subs in space. So it's, you know, that's great. I can memorize Star Trek facts, but that's not useful. That's not going to, you know, as entertaining as that is, it's not useful. It's not going to achieve anything, you know. I wasn't interested in being dismayed about climate change, or the different access to energy across different developed countries. So I thought, okay, well, this is an issue, because at the very least, it shouldn't be banned in Australia. So let's make that the goal. Advocate for it being legalized, and everything I find out and talk about it is can revolve around that.
Yeah, sweet. Because if my notes are correct, you started the Actinide Age around about 2014.
Sounds right.
Yeah, so that was that when Ben had started Decarbonize SA, or he must have started that previously.
2012,
right?
He could confirm, and it was a little while after Barry Brook, which I think was 2010 or earlier.
Gotcha. That's sweet, because you've had a I mean, it's not just your blog being the Actinide Age. You've actually had you've actually built from that, and you've got a couple of articles on Medium. Obviously, you wrote articles for Bright New World, and now also sort of for Replanet. So we can see, you know, what your motivation for this advocacy was. Mm-hmm. What portion of your motivation for this issue sort of comes from, say, like an environmental or conservation side of things, and then maybe what portion comes from, you know, being good at your job and providing value to what you do for your living?
Right. It's mostly the former. The idea of powering Australian factories with nuclear electricity and heat is realistically a long way off. And I'll come back to that if you don't let me forget, because it's a matter of, for me, it was a matter of looking at the data. Back when it was hard to get a lot of the data all in one place, but we know now, after decades of scrutiny, which has involved, you know, sifting through the noise. There's signal to noise, and the signal's getting a lot stronger now. But you know, the noise has always been that nuclear power is high impact, you know. The high risk, extremely high impact. The mining takes is high impact. The consequences are a massive burden, but that's not what the good information spells out. It's dense and low impact. It's technically known. We can basically situate a factory that makes heat and power next to the consumers of heat and power, and all this factory does is output heat and power, and everything else is contained. Undeniably, there's a planning aspect to it, but I personally operate a 50-year-old factory I'd like to see operate for many more decades. long-term operation of industrial facilities is not a novel idea. And South Australia has had brewing industry for hundreds, well over 100 years. When you start a nuclear industry, that's a 100 plus year commitment for a region. Every time you put these things this in context, you go, well, hang on, it's not actually that different.
I get what you're saying, but I suppose so much of, I suppose, technology today, a lot of things, especially I suppose with consumer electronics, where the technology is moving so fast and people are, there are telco companies that provide a plans where you get a new phone every year. It's kind of very disposable and that, and probably, I'm wondering if something like that creates an expectation that conventional industry like what you're talking about, where it runs for 50 or 100 years, people don't understand that. People think, well, it must be old, it must be outdated, it's not the way we do things. Care to reflect on that?
Yeah, I think you have a very good point there. That's a perception. That's not necessarily anything new, because a sort of a dismay from people with my sort of background in science isn't anything new when it comes to popular perception of technology. Now we have phones and technology in our houses, which tend to be replaceable on a long, on a short-term basis. And then we also have things like we have sources of energy, where it is at a human scale, and at a household scale. I have panels on my roof, and many people, everybody knows what that's like. A solar panel is a human scale piece of technology. If you have a barbecue, you have a gas bottle, or charcoal briquettes. That sort of fossil fuels are at a human scale. What you put in your car, You can visit a wind farm, and there's the wind turbine right there. Stretching the analogy a bit there, but it's still, yep, there's that thing. It's here. I can come up and touch it. So it can be a big ask for some people, that you go from that to, yeah, it's a full-on factory. It's a big industrial site. It is removed. It's something for advocates to reflect on, probably, that a different scale, a different perception, and you can quite successfully discuss the need for including nuclear technology for clean energy, but there's underneath acceptance of that, there's how people would interact with it. You just can't interact with it like you can climb up on your roof and wash your panels.
I think this is where they've, I can't remember, it would have been on a on Decouple or Titans of Nuclear, one of the episodes, I can't remember which, but they would talk about in the States where they would typically have nuclear power stations open, and there would be daily tours or open to the public. Now, I think there were issues with, I think, COVID or I think 9/11, a lot of that got shut down, but it was a portion of public outreach which I think they found was very valuable, and when they actually stopped doing it, they certainly found there was a negative impact to not doing it, that a that they could measure that was palpable.
That's my understanding, and what's been very positive very recently, whatever else you think about the Plant Vogtle expansion in Georgia with the Westinghouse AP100 reactors there, We've seen some of the prominent US-based advocates clearly that they've been invited to tour the place and do a lot of media there, which is a step back in the right direction,
Definitely,
clearly,
considering that
to
how fraught that whole project has been. Now I think they've just started up the number three, the first new reactor.
yeah, which is great to see. And but on top of this, you do have the people who may be recognizable only in energy Twitter circles, but they're there.
They're day in the
They're
spotlight for
putting a
more.
human face on it.
For more broad-scale media.
They're putting a deserved human face on it. And that's at least a step back to what I guess were good old days, where you did have, as I understand it, school groups touring various nuclear plants in the US. Security is pretty tight, as I understand it. But we're talking about national assets, right?
Well, we have that here as well. I mean, whenever they bring a new uranium plates in from abroad to power the Opal reactor, from what I understand, there's a massive police convoy to escort it from the airport to the facility. And I think anyone who sort of understands the processing, okay, this is overkill. It doesn't need to be this involved. Maybe, okay, you could argue it's a good exercise, and if nothing else, it's a good way to drill your police force and situations like that. But it's probably overkill for what it actually is.
There's overkill, visible security, but then there's an aspect to it which I think is probably easy for someone who has experience in industrial settings. There's best practice, and you adhere to best practice, whether it is compliance with your record keeping or security measures set by international standards. And my understanding is any material involved with Lucas Heights, they are very careful with best practice.
For sure. My last few interviews covered the issues resulting from the dissolution of the SEC and the just transition in the Latrobe Valley. South Australia is the poster child for the renewable energy transition of Australia. So, how do you find this affecting your state?
South Australia does get cited a lot. It's kind of weird down here on the ground, because if you look at, a site like Electricity Maps and have a bit of a click through, you can see that we've had substantial year-on-year emissions reduction. It's in terms of emissions intensity. If we're gonna stick with numbers here, the emissions intensity in grams of carbon dioxide and equivalent per kilowatt hour energy of electrical energy produced or consumed, it's been pushed down, notably since we stopped consuming brown coal. Wind power is a major source here. Curiously, you can't see a wind farm from anywhere in Adelaide, which probably doesn't isn't something most people notice, but certainly see a lot of rooftop solar. We don't tend to think about, well, electricity is pretty, like, electricity is relatively clean now, so what's the problem in just using lots of it now? I don't think it's really connected in the public mind to overcoming the idea of being efficient with electricity, you know, or trying to reduce consumption at all times, which is, you know, since last century has sort of been the dominant narrative, to be frugal with it. As I said, with an industrial facility, that's natural, but for your average household, you heat the house when you need to heat it, and you turn your AC on when you want to, and there's always going to be, I think there's going to be resistance to some extent in being told to minimize that, but obviously the major driver there is the cost, because retail prices haven't dropped. They seem to be set to increase. Wholesale, I was just checking the AER charts on wholesale prices, which are also increasing. And if I can get technical for a little bit, we have wholesale prices in the electricity market, and they track the data on what energy source is actually setting the price. So there's price setters. Now we tend to have like 50% wind energy generated here in a quarter, but that will only set the price for maybe 20% of the time, which raises the question for me at least, what is the logic behind saying, well, wind is a cheap source of energy, therefore adding more will make energy cheap, but it's not setting the price proportion to how much is there. I'd really like to see a clear explanation of this apparent paradox.
It seems to me that the situation you have is the way we've set up our market and the way, or the electricity market and the way it's set up in many places around the world, is that you have your auction and you have the price setters. And I'm guessing in South Australia, the price setter is typically gas, which is something that is dispatchable and can be called upon whenever you need it. You can have wind, and you can have more wind and try and increase the total capacity of the wind. But if you're relying on something that is fundamentally intermittent, it doesn't really matter how much you have. Well, you're always going to have a disproportionate reliance on gas to meet those gaps.
Maybe it's that simple, and it would be really valuable for that to be teased out of the data. You're right, a lot of it is set by gas. A lot of it's set by, according to the charts, a lot of it's set by import coal and hydro from interstate, and they tend to be lower, whereas wind and solar, to a lesser extent, tend to be negative, like vastly negative. Now, they're setting price in the negative at a lower proportion, but wholesale costs aren't pushed down by that to an extent that reduces, you know, bills for consumers.
My understanding is whenever you have a price that sets it at negative, the reason for that is because it's got nowhere to go, it's zero value.
Yeah, I mean that's the spot price. It's less clear how this relates to the price setting behavior of the technology. There may be a technical explanation in a report somewhere, but it's not going to be accessible to the general public in any meaningful way. And I really think it should. I think it should be impartially conveyed to the public by someone who can do it responsibly, to sort of try to start clearing up this paradox. Because what's the obvious solution to the intermittency, so that you could get these negative prices having more of an effect more of the time? Well, storage, right? So yes, here's South Australia, a bit of a poster child What did we do? Well, Elon Musk struck a deal to put the first big battery in, which does some things very well, according to the data. And we have a couple more. Now, the price-setting behavior of the battery storage that we have now is also tracked. And it's a tiny proportion. In fact, battery output is a tiny proportion of South Australian supply generally. However, you will still see journalists make the mistake of claiming that South Australia is mainly powered by solar, wind, and batteries, when battery output is a fraction of what imports tend to be. So that can't help but get a bit annoyed by that.
It frustrates me when people consider the battery such a massive success because it's already paid for itself. I'm not surprised it's already paid for itself, but it's not really solving the problems which it's ostensibly been placed.
Right, it hasn't paid for itself by supplying time-shifted renewable energy, which is what the perception tends to be. It is acting as a price setter a very small percentage of the time. It's setting the price in hundreds and hundreds of dollars per megawatt hour. That would
the people who own it are making bank.
Well, it's natural, right? You buy low and sell high. Anyone investing in battery storage is going to want the operators to run it that way, right? Buy low and sell high. Mm. So this is the question that we need to ask honestly: is time shifting bulk solar and wind through batteries isn't going to deliver this cheap solar and wind? The cheap solar and wind, tends to be good when used right, but it's not going to be cheap after going through a battery. And now we're starting to see an investigation of this on Twitter with new analysis of these sorts of simplistic claims about firming up solar and wind in this way. I think things are starting to shift on the perception around this. We're getting better data. Like we've started getting a lot better data. When I started doing this, you almost had to scrape together sources and then build your own data sets. Now we have so much better information to cite, and it makes it faster. You can write a small blog piece with a bunch of citations to really decent sources like the IEA or Ember, and all the data's right there, which is so much easier now. And not only is it there, but it tends to be nuclear positive as well, which, to be frank, it's good to have the opposition on the back foot in terms of the authoritative references you can employ. Makes it a bit of an ask if someone argues with them. The IEA literature is quite clear about including nuclear energy, and a lot of outlets have come around to being softly positive on it. Bloomberg, Ember Climate, quite a few others. I like to highlight these as I go on the little time I spend on Twitter. I just want to highlight to everybody whatever else the anti-nuclear campaign is claiming. They can't claim to have all of the authoritative information sources on their side. And it tends to make Australia sort of stand out a bit, because we do have authorities which are so resistant to this still.
I think you're right. I think the ship is turning around slowly. I don't think it's one particular thing that's done it. I think it's multiple things. I think it's sort of the struggles that we're experiencing worldwide with the renewable transition. I think it's also a lot of the grassroots organisations like Eric Meyer and Generation Atomic, and obviously what you guys did with Bright New World. I think it's a the industry itself starting to find out that, oh, okay, there are people that support it. I mean, if you look at Australia, the most recent polling is that it's half the population is kind of in favour of it, and it's been increasing sort of year on year gradually. It's still, you know, a lot of pushback, and there's obviously there's still the institutions in Australia which are, well, let's call a spade, still resistant to it. But yeah, I think things are turning around slowly, gradually. Be nice if it was moving a bit quicker, but well.
We saw it happen quite dramatically in the US in like maybe 5 years ago.
But obviously they sort of had a much better position to start from, having the largest civilian nuclear fleet in the world.
They did, and then they had sort of, I guess, a blogosphere where it was constant sniping at each other over issues of renewable energy, energy efficiency, and the stalled nuclear renaissance. And then cooler heads prevailed and came together to talk to each other. And I think around that time, really effective advocacy groups grew up to properly engage with politicians and build a real consensus, a political consensus around it. And the anti-nuclear outlets were marginalized. It actually seemed to happen quite quickly. And it was, yeah, a hopeful time. And it remains like that. It seemed to have a resilience from the outset. You know, it hasn't faltered. And, you know, back then we were wondering, you know, how long is it going to take to see SMRs get through licensing? You know, it still seems like such a way off, but it's happening in a timely way. It really is, you know, all else considered. With multiple shots on goal, whether you're thinking about New Scale or X Energy or Holtec or GE, Hitachi, or TerraPower, you know, we had this Nuclear Fuel Cycle Royal Commission back in 2015, 2016, and the idea of this sort of progress was unthought of. It's not even been 10 years, and they have eyes on the finish line over in the US and the UK, and obviously Canada. There's progress. It's a lot of passionate people, many of whom I met early on, and I, you know, I know that they're genuine. It's actually genuine human beings who have gotten off Twitter and gotten to work, and you know, been so effective, and it's inspirational.
You recently announced that you're now an advisor to the NGO Replanets. Now, last year I spoke with Tyrone Delisle, who was starting to assist with, you know, a new NGO called Replanet in mainland of Europe. And it now appears to sort of be growing with branches in Portugal, Africa, and now here in Australia. Sort of, how did this come about?
Yeah, I think it's safe to say Tyrone drove this, at least in the rapid way it's happened. Got it up and running. Setting up all, there's a lot of paperwork goes into this stuff, so he's been a real gun with having all that organized. And you can find Replanet at replanet.au. nice and simple. Have a browse through a website. More stuff's being added to it regularly, but as far as Replanet's kind of a Generation 2 eco-modernist organization. And it's a collection of, it's a grassroots collection of issues that need to be addressed. We start with examining the science on the issues, and then we advocate accordingly. So if you look on the website about what we believe, you know, for example, global prosperity allows for protecting the environment. So we want to protect the environment, at least in one way, through enhancing global prosperity, clean energy, access to clean and affordable energy, access to modern agriculture and modernizing agriculture, and access to resources for resilience, help with increasing global prosperity, you know, globally. Another example would be recently collaborating with a couple of other organizations to produce the World Wants Nuclear Report. It analyzed the surveys performed in 8 countries on views on nuclear energy and acceptance and excitement for new advanced nuclear energy. So the results from that were very positive. And Tyrone asked me to write that up, so I was able to review a bunch of that information. And there's a little report there that I wrote. And he got me to follow on with a blog about the history of the surveys and polling on attitudes to nuclear energy in Australia. So, you know, we do echo a lot of what the global, or European focus, but global issues the Replanet deals with, but we do also localize it to Australia as well. And further to that, we are increasingly engaging with consultation processes at state level and federal, and I'm just working on finalizing a response to South Australia's Green Paper on energy transition and net zero energy, net zero emissions. So hopefully I'll have a post to cover that as well soon, coming up. And we, over in the eastern states at least, getting more involved with collaborating with other NGOs on the ground, because clean energy aside, there's environmental, there's conservation issues that we want to build networks around. There's urban planning and conservation of biodiversity. So all the various people on the team put a lot of energy into that. And then also keep your eyes and ears out, everybody, for around near the end of August, there'll be a special international event dropping. Which should be pretty exciting.
Okay. Yeah. Can you tell us any more about that, or is that still under wraps? Okay, then. Fair enough. We'll keep our eyes out for it. So it seems that a lot of Replanet's views reflect very closely on those once held by Bright New World. Is that accurate?
Broadly, Replanet would have been what Bright New World expanded into. Bright New World punched above its weight at the time, but it was just us three guys, basically at a limit. Any sort of plans to expand would have taken more energy than we had, and changes in careers just made that unfeasible.
It was an idea ahead of its time.
We got a lot achieved. I think Bright New World, as soon as it was up and running, it became a point of contact for a lot of journalists, for example.
Yep.
For politicians who wanted to explore these issues, and it gave permission to have the conversation to a lot more people than just a individual writing a blog or publishing videos does. Having a full-blown advocacy organization, there's an aspect to it that doesn't you don't get from anything else.
Yep.
So Replanet now has a bigger tent for issues, which is going to be great, because it's not just about like the focus of expanding clean energy options in Australia. It's food, it's rewilding, afforestation, urban planning, and engaging with tons of different aspects of policy. So yeah, it's a a lot more capability now. I mean, obviously, I wanted to put a bit of time into it. I can't remember if I volunteered or Tyrone approached me. Probably was
Bit of column A, bit of column
50-50,
B.
right? And in the meantime, Ben has represented it at a function, and yeah, there's sort of a, I think the original trio help where we can. Got a lot to offer. Having a continuation, a bit of continuity there, has helped because,
It may have shut
tacitly.
down, but it wasn't in vain.
That's right, and tacitly, it's just the continuity is there. And back last decade, the objection, like coming back to nuclear energy, the objections, dominated by perceived disastrous harms from Fukushima Daiichi, and then all of the other myths that had gone unchallenged for so long. And as information became better available and better communicated by an authoritative source, we honed our messages as carefully as we could at Bright New World, and certainly we're doing that at Replanet. But think about what's been walked back in terms of opposition. Everyone, nobody claims that nuclear energy is high emissions anymore. Nobody claims that the accidents are deadly. Everyone concedes that there are nations that use nuclear safely to get low emission grids. And no one really has a. Have you heard anyone have a problem with them using Australian uranium in their reactors? I haven't heard that for years.
No.
Basically, everyone agrees that Germany shouldn't have shut down their reactors.
Well, that's becoming very apparent right now. I think their
Germany
industry
should.
is
Germany
crumbling.
was the golden child, the golden boy of how to transition, and that's just not anymore. And the US is saving its reactors from being shut down for whatever reason. You've even seen, incidentally, we've even seen like Bill McKibben, who created 350.org, say that the US reactors should be kept going. That all of the howling, stubborn objections are just sloughing off like dead skin.
Well, it seems to me that so much of the objection was out there. It was based on, I suppose, rhetoric and emotion. And it hasn't been that when, I suppose, now that the other side has actually stepped up and has been able to refer back, to the facts
Right,
and
there was
stick
an
to the facts.
information vacuum,
That's a good way to
and
put it, an information vacuum.
and so it was full of noise, and now the good information is providing the signal, and it's pushed the noise out. Well, it's slowly pushing the noise out. Some of the noise has disappeared immediately.
Some of it's a
Some is
bit more
stubborn and
stubborn.
sticks around.
There's a lot of very well-funded anti-organisations out there.
Well, yeah, and
Now look, money talks.
No less than James Hansen has made this point, and so it's not like it's a conspiracy theory that interested parties fund anti-nuclear organizations, but they just don't get, if they get traction, I'm not sure where it is, and I'm not sure how much longer it's going to last for.
My sort of take on Bright New World is it kind of existed in a really good time period because I think Ben started up just at the closure of the results from the 2015 Royal Commission in South Australia, or that closed off in 2016. Started up Bright New World, and that sort of continued through to it was July, June or July last year, or was it the year before, 21 or
Year poor,
22?
I think.
But that time period captured three government inquiries into nuclear legislation, the federal one, the Victorian one, the New South Wales one. And did it cap was it there for AUKUS as well when AUKUS was announced?
No,
No, it was
no.
before AUKUS. Okay, but I think it occurred at a key time where those three inquiries came about. Would you care to reflect on sort of what you think about that or the time that it existed?
Very proud of the submissions we made to those inquiries, and the amount of citation we received. Obviously, two of those inquiries had confirmed the main result of the South Australian Royal Commission, which was that the prohibition should be lifted.
Yeah, I'm ashamed of Victoria for the mealy
Well,
mouth results that came from that.
to reflect on Victoria, I mean, what else illustrates the issues there better than Ben and Dane fronting up to
The Equality
the
Commission. I
committee
remember
there
watching it.
and having instead of it being an inquiry into the prohibition, the laws in Victoria, it turned into an inquiry into funding sources for Brand New World.
Yeah.
How absolutely typical of anti-nuclear people
It's the last
to
argument they
forget what they're
have.
doing and start demanding who funds you,
Yeah.
start playing shill bingo. So I think that was, it ended up not being very productive for the conversation, but it was a real success for showing just how desperate they can look, right? These are your elected representatives, and they've got nothing better to do than parrot
Well, it's all they
these
have.
demands. Oh, so yeah, it was clearly that inquiry was going to be derailed, but the cooler heads there, props to them for their efforts, and you can still go back and watch that footage. And Ben and Dane make some very, very good points and some prophetic ones, about how the current energy transition planning is insufficient. So the fact that Ben, Dane, and to a lesser extent I were on top of a lot of that current technical issues really helped us punch above our weight in that way. Yeah, very proud of what we did, and it was a lot of fun, to be frank.
Personally, I admire what you three did with that particular organisation. I think it's a I think it's a
I
it's
admire your
presented a lot of,
hashtag.
sorry?
I admire your hashtag.
Oh, thank you very much. Yes, no, that's my repeal 140A. I kicked that one off, and it seems that the energy Twitter in my in my small corner of a of Twitter has quite happily adopted that one. So yeah, no, that's good. Now, you've actually, coming to Twitter, you've been quite active on Twitter, or X as it is now. I don't know what Elon Musk is thinking, changing the name of it, but let's still call it Twitter. Everyone understands what that is. Active on energy Twitter for several years. Sort of, what are your thoughts on this platform?
It's changed a lot, hasn't it? But I don't know. I think I decided to withdraw from it as much as I could a couple months back, because basically you have just wonderful personalities like Isodope now
Yes.
flying the flag, and it's almost like, wow, her legitimacy is recognized by everybody who's serious about this stuff. Just point people to her. She has and not just her, but as an example, it's all you need. It's far from anti-nuclear organizations with their accounts on Twitter being able to drown out grassroots nuclear advocacy. It's more like we've won, actually. And again, it makes Australia look like a bit of a Luddite, because all across the world, you've got nuclear energy and influences having all this influence, bringing the information, bringing the good data, and carving out the space. So, as another example, Our World in Data, is a fantastic website, and the people who run it quite happy to talk about how nuclear, alongside the rest of the clean energy sources, all of its benefits, and you can just ignore the haters. So Twitter can be really toxic, but inside of energy Twitter, it's probably healthier than it's ever been, signal to noise wise. And you can really just sort of withdraw and put your energy elsewhere because, again, someone like Isodope has it in hand. Got it under control.
I think that's right. I've sort of noticed it myself that, and I haven't withdrawn totally, and I do like Twitter in that once you've set up your profile and who you follow and whatnot, it can be a very powerful tool into keeping abreast of what the developments are in, for you know, my instance, nuclear technology. Oh, Vogtle's up and running. Oh, this, the NuScale passed this barrier, the NRC and whatnot. I found it very good for that. I don't mind engaging with people from time to time, but once you get stuck into a sort of some arguments, you can really spend your time arguing with a lot of people that is just not worth your energy. And there's one particular thread I'm still attached to. It amazes me how long it's gone this long. There's an interesting point to put into it. You probably know the one I'm talking about as well, but it started off when Greta Thunberg posted a tweet about the, the European Union, and it was on the eve of them voting on whether nuclear would be included as part of their green investment portfolio things. Right. And there's any number of branching arguments from that, and there's one that's been going on with a couple of people I follow. And it just keeps going, but
just keeps going. I think I muted it or left the conversation months ago. But it was weird that, that spawned from a tweet where she explicitly excluded nuclear, and then, if I remember right, the next tweet she put out on the subject explicitly didn't mention nuclear. Which was very curious.
Yes.
And then, I think very just around that time, she mentioned in an interview that indeed Germany should keep running their plants. So, if any anti-nuclear organizations, especially the really rabid ones in Europe, were counting on trading on her credibility, then that all fell out the window at the time. So that was, something to watch. Sometimes it's just, you know, you just watch what's happening on Twitter. Sometimes there's so much going on, you don't even need to resist the urge to comment. Just watch what's happening.
Sometimes I often find myself, seriously, Logan, release more episodes. That's a more productive use of your time. Anyway.
Exactly.
So, look, personal life. You've mentioned that you live and you work with sort of autism, and you support an immunocompromised partner. Do you care to comment on that, or speak on that, and how energy could or impacts your lives?
Yeah, we're an autistic family here, and indeed, I received diagnosis of adult diagnosed ADHD last year. So. The appropriate medication for that has been very beneficial. Not at all interested in shame around medication. And as far as multiple sclerosis goes, you know, if you're going to have a immunocompromised condition, it's probably the one to have because how well known it is and how well set up the fundraising is for research into it. The medicines you get these days are next generation. They're absolutely next level. It's amazing what they can do. You know, just to reflect on that for a bit, we need modernity in our society to be able to support access to disease modulating treatment like this. There's no compromise and no alternative but to have a advanced society so that my partner and many others are able to access this medication that vastly improves their outlook. Similarly, for disabilities, you know, the disability associated with that, but also disabilities associated with neurodivergence. In an advanced society, allows for a lot of visibility and advocacy around that. So, you know, philosophically, I have to oppose any ideas about walking any of that back. In extreme examples where we're having sort of pastoral fantasies about simpler times, I just wholesale reject that. We need to maintain complex modern times to support the disabled, to support victims of lifelong diseases. You know, these high-tech medicines, they come from a ultimately they're the products of a vast technological industrial base that we have functioning at the moment. I intend to work to keeping that functioning and improved. That sort of underlies what the way I think about these things, and it aligns with broader ideas about global improvements in poverty reduction, energy access, and effective informed climate action.
I think we're over an hour now, so I think we're probably better wrap it up. Is there anything else you'd like to close out with before we cap this one off?
Please consider visiting replanet.au and join up. If you want to help out, and donations are welcome. Come by our Twitter account and say hi. Watch out for the events we're planning, and you can come by our Discord and chat if you like. So it's been a real pleasure being on to have a chat on this cold morning.
No, I can actually see through the video.
Seeping through my feet now,
I can actually
but
see through
it's
the video. You've exhaled a couple of times. I've seen the
yeah.
seen your
I'm gonna have to
breath.
go get another hot coffee, I think. But it's
Look, no problem. Look, thank you very much for agreeing to speak to me, and thank you for appearing on Going Fishing. This has been really good.
always a pleasure.
Once again, I'd like to thank Oscar for agreeing to appear on Going Fishing. This was a great interview. In the show notes, there will be a link to his Twitter profile as well as his LinkedIn page. I've also included links to his blog, The Actinide Age, and his page on Medium. Additionally, there are links to the Global Replanet and Replanet Australia websites. Finally, there is a link to the video mentioned in the interview where Bright New World presented to the Victorian Inquiry into Nuclear Energy. Thank you very much for listening. This has been Going Fishing, hosted by Logan Smith.